Thank you, Your Honor. Phil Pearson, 19922, representing the plaintiff appellant in this matter. I would like to reserve 5 minutes.
Try to keep an eye on that.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to start out by focusing on the history of duty analysis in Colorado going back to about 25 years ago, almost to the month, when the Supreme Court came out with Taco Bell and DU versus Whitlock. The issue in the Taco Bell case, does Taco Bell have a duty to its patrons to take reasonable measures to protect them from armed robbery? The issue in Whitlock was, does DU have the duty to protect its students who are on a trampoline at a fraternity house? They decided those in opposite ways on the same day and held that here's how we're going to do it. We're going to do it with the standard of fairness under contemporary standards. It says that a reasonable person would recognize the duty and agree that it should be imposed. Keep in mind, contemporary standards back then, and that was 25 years ago, it was pre-internet, pre-telemedicine, pre-physician extenders, as far as the major use of physician extenders. In Colorado, they said, how do we do that? We're going to use various factors, and they used 5, which are well briefed by both sides. I would like to point out that in medical malpractice, this is relatively new. Medical malpractice, the first medical malpractice cases along this line were Greenberg versus Perkins and Healthline versus Rodriguez. They basically said the same thing. We're going to use the same analysis in Colorado, that is, fairness under contemporary standards, such that a reasonable person would agree it exists. And they used the same 5 standards. Other cases and other courts throughout the land, as you're well aware, have come down with many different opinions using many, many different standards. And I would urge the court to consider those along these lines. As the Colorado Supreme Court said in Taco Bell and DU versus Whitlock, these factors depend on the circumstances in each case. They listed some of the factors, but they pointed out no one factor is controlling. Other considerations may be relevant, and this is not an exhaustive list.
Counsel, this was a 12B5. So can you kind of focus on the complaint in this case and tell me where the duty arises in this case based on the complaint?
Where does the complaint state the duty?
Yeah, where's the legal duty in this case as written in the complaint?
It is in paragraph 27 of the complaint. It's in the middle of the first claim for relief. And it says, with respect to the phone, is that close enough? Yes, please see.
Yes, please.
With respect to the phone advice given to Dr. Cavanaugh for the purposes of medical evaluation, care and treatment of decedent James Dinkle, defendant Pablo owed a duty to Mr. Dinkle to exercise that degree of skill, care, caution, diligence, and foresight exercised by an expected of neurologists under the same or similar circumstances.
What phone advice? Given.
That it was okay to wait until the next day to do the MRI.
Does the complaint say that?
No. But further on in paragraph, at least in 27 it doesn't, further on in 28, it says, by failing to obtain the proper information regarding Mr. Dinkle, failing to see, question, and examine Mr. Dinkle, and or failure to advise Dr. Cavanaugh to have Mr. Dinkle seen immediately. That's in paragraph 28.
Well, all of those allegations assume that this doctor assumed a duty? I mean, he would have no duty to do any of those things unless he took on that duty, because he clearly didn't have a doctor-patient relationship.
Well, that's, I would disagree that he, with the analysis of there clearly was not a doctor-patient relationship. I would say that he did not have a traditional doctor-patient relationship and that he wasn't his patient. However, I think in Colorado, what we do is we put the analysis of duty first. That is there a duty? Do we have a duty based on all these factors? And if we find a duty, then we say, well, there's the physician-patient relationship. But you don't have to have a physician-patient relationship in Colorado, as per Greenberg versus Perkins and Health One versus Rodriguez.
I ask you, Dr. Pearson, I guess I'm struggling where the line is and what rule you're asking us to adopt. I understand what you just said about Greenberg and Health One. Maybe it's easy to pose the hypothetical to you. There would be two, and the ultimate question is going to be, are you suggesting there's a duty in every time there's a phone consultation, now that you can have a range? The phone call can be really, in one of the out-of-state cases cited, talks about, it's analogous to a, like going to a book. I've called the consulting physician, and it's just a research resource. The doctor made the call. I'm going to decide what to do. I'm just doing research. The other extreme would be, I've talked to you, I've told you who the patient is, I've told you all the facts, etc. The calling doctor knows, the consulting doctor knows, the calling doctor is relying on the consultant, and maybe you'd have a duty there. What is the test you're asking us to adopt? Because it sounds to me, it's like in some places your brief, you were suggesting there's always a duty to use reasonable care when you're doing a phone consult, and I'm not sure the cases go that far. So can you help me understand the rule you're asking us to adopt here, and then I guess I need some more clarity. After you tell me what that rule is, why does your complaint satisfy it?
In the test I would like you to adopt is the one stated in the first two cases I mentioned, that is fairness under contemporary standards, such that a reasonable person would agree that a duty exists. Using the factors as listed there, plus the other factors that all the other cases, plus any other factors that might be pertinent, such as assumption of duty, restatement second of torts 324A, such as was the advice general or specific, some of the cases use that, or was there a contractual duty, not here, was there malfeasance versus nonfeasance, was there a previous relationship between the players, who is in the best position to take precautions to assess the risk and avoid the danger? Was it foreseeable that there would be reliance on that? All those factors taken in. So that's the test I'm asking you to place here. And in the complaint, it, in paragraph 28, I think, says failure to give reasonable advice.
I guess I'm pausing because I find that of some concern. The policy issues Mr. Young raises, of course, you could have a problem when it seems quite broad. I mean, and I guess my question, don't you need to hear at least plead that Dr. Pavo was consulted here and was told all the information? You argue a lot of things in your brief that I'm not sure are in the complaint. The brief makes a better argument than the complaint does. We're here on a motion to dismiss. Yes, what in the complaint establishes the fact that Dr. Pavo was closer to the consulting doctor who was making decisions here and giving advice in a specific case versus just a research tool? I'm not sure we have enough facts in the complaint to make that call.
Well, actually, what you can use is the pleadings. And in the pleadings, that's the complaint, or that's the motion to dismiss, and the response to that. In the response to that is included some deposition testimony from Dr. Kavanaugh, which in effect may convert this to a Rule 56 determination as well. And we would not allow, we didn't get any extra discovery, so really we had the detriment of a 12B5 but not the benefits of a 56.
Your complaint make reference to that deposition?
No, the complaint itself does not.
And we're limited in our review to the four corners of the complaint, are we not?
Well, I think actually not anymore, because in the pleadings, we referenced some deposition testimony that was not objected to or excluded, and so that converts it to a 56. I think I'll sit down now.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is David Yoon, and my registration number is 23448. I represent Defendant Appellee Dr. Pierre Pavel. I think the central issue in this case is whether a physician owes a duty to a person who is not his patient for giving curbside or informal advice to the treating physician. The standard of review is de novo. It's a question of law for the court to determine whether or not Dr. Pavel owed a legal duty to the deceased, Mr. Dinkle. And I think the analysis is very simple. Plaintiff asserted a medical malpractice claim. Because there's no physician-patient relationship, that claim fails. As the court knows, a medical malpractice claim is a particular type of a negligence claim. The duty owed under a medical malpractice claim arises out of a professional relationship between the physician and the patient.
What do you do with the argument that Rodriguez and Greenberg have altered what you just said?
I handled the Health One versus Rodriguez, and I do know for a fact that claim involved a ordinary negligence claim that Dr. Ogin owed a duty under an ordinary negligence claim because he left a vial of phenol, an affirmative conduct, on the nerve cart, which later was misused by another physician. So it was those facts. And I do not believe the court had addressed in that case what the plaintiff is alleging, which is a duty to diagnose, treat, or refer the patient. And that's a malpractice claim. And that's what they alleged in the complaint, I believe.
Can I ask you, Mr. Yoon, obviously you know that we're not bound by the labels in the complaint. So let me just take a hypothetical. I don't think you would agree with this, but let's say we could read this as a negligence claim and not a medical malpractice claim. Let's say we can read it that way if we ignore labels or whatever. Could there be a duty in that situation if, hypothetically, what the let's say the plaintiff alleged, I consulted with your client, with Dr. Pavel. I told him everything about who the patient was. He knew I was relying on him and knew that I was going to take his advice and treat the patient based on the advice. Would that not give rise to a duty even though there was no patient-physician relationship?
I do not believe so, because as the court knows, the Colorado law distinguishes between nonfeasance and misfeasance cases. And as I understand the Supreme Court's ruling, and here's the distinction that the Supreme Court said. The reason for the distinction may be said to lie in the fact that by misfeasance, the defendant has created a new risk of harm to the plaintiff, while by nonfeasance, he has at least made his situation no worse or has merely failed to benefit him by interfering his affairs. In this case, Dr. Pavel's phone call did not create a new risk to Mr. Dinkle. Claims allegations are that Mr. Dinkle already had a progressively worsening neurological condition when the phone call occurred, I believe the night before he was hospitalized. So instead, plaintiff's allegation is that Dr. Pavel should have intervened and prevented an already deteriorating condition. And as I understand the distinction between when there's a nonfeasance case, absent a special relationship, such as a physician-patient relationship, that claim fails as a matter of law, and you do not have to go through the Taco Bell or the multi-factor test. And I believe that the Colorado Court of Appeal, as well as the Supreme Court in Whitlock, said that. I believe the case by the Colorado Court of Appeals is the Smith case, S-M-I-T.
What case were you citing at the beginning of your statement there?
I was citing the Greenberg case.
That's where that quote was from?
Yes, that it arises out of a professional relationship and that it is a contractual. It's predicated on a contractual relationship.
Well, you have, and obviously I'm just trying to find the line here, Mr. Yun, so I'm pushing you a little bit. There are out-of-state cases that I think were recited by Dr. Pearson in his pleadings that suggest you can imply the contractual relationship in certain phone consultations, depending on the nature of the call.
Yes.
And so I guess I'm not 100% clear on the nonfeasance, misfeasance distinction you're making. Let's take, this is hypothetical, but let's take that, assume, and I'll say it was Dr. Prevost. Say he's called, and Dr. Kavanaugh says, you know, Doctor, I don't know anything about this area. I need some help how to treat this patient. So what do you think I need to do? And he says, he'll be fine. Isn't that arguably misfeasance? If somebody alleges he should have told me I needed to admit him right away, I told him I was relying on him. Wouldn't that be misfeasance or a duty in that situation?
I don't think so, because I think the Supreme Court's distinction is much broader than what the court is saying, whether or not he failed to do something as opposed to doing something active. I think what the court is actually saying, did you make the situation any worse?
So the duty, let me try to make sure I understand. So there would be a duty in your view if, for example, and this is hypothetical, Dr. Prevost said, give him this medication, and then he was injured by that medication. I told him to do something affirmatively as opposed to failing to tell him to do
yes.
So. Okay.
So if you prescribe new medication that creates a new risk of harm, then that would be a misfeasance. And absent that, there has to be a special relationship to have a duty to protect that harm. And if the court will look at their complaint, it is clear to me, if you look at paragraph 28, that they are actually asserting that Dr. Prevost failed to obtain proper information regarding Mr. Dinkle, failed to see, question, exam Mr. Dinkle, failed to advise Dr. Kavanaugh to have Mr. Dinkle seen immediately by a specialist, failed to timely diagnose, treat, care for, consultation on Mr. Dinkle. The duty they're trying to seek, impose, is to require Dr. Prevost to essentially become the patient's doctor by obligating him to evaluate, diagnose, treat, and refer him to a specialist. And that, you need a physician-patient relationship, and they don't have that in this case. And they admit in the opening brief, as well in the response, and in the court ordered, that Mr. Dinkle and his wife did not even know the existence of Dr. Prevost. They didn't even know or aware of this telephone conversation even existed until the deposition. There's no allegation that Dr. Prevost actually reviewed any medical records or reviewed any diagnostic test. Instead, the allegation is that all of the information was conveyed from Dr. Kavanaugh to Dr. Prevost. And there's no allegation whatsoever that he was compensated for this phone consultation. Only thing we know is it's not even recorded in the medical record. And as I understand the practice of medicine, you have to put a consultation on the medical record if you're going to get compensated. So there was no physician-patient relationship. And I believe plaintiff's counsel even admits as much in the trial court. Their position was, even though there's no traditional physician-patient relationship, a duty still exists. And they admitted even in the reply brief, I believe in the reply brief, he said, we did argue at the trial court that the real issue in these cases is that the traditional physician-patient relationship is not necessarily required in order to establish duty. That was their argument in the trial court. So I think it's clear that there is no physician-patient relationship.
Your counterpart made a point of saying that despite the fact that it's a 12B5 motion to dismiss, that there was a deposition attached to some briefing and that we should consider elevating it to Rule 56. Can you respond to that?
I don't think that's what the trial court considered. I believe the trial court considered,
Should it have considered it as a Rule 56 once there was additional a record testimony attached to a brief?
No, I believe he quoted a portion of the deposition. It wasn't submitted as a deposition or sworn testimony. But I don't think that that little fact alters the conclusion that there's no duty owed. All he basically says is Dr. Kavanaugh conveyed what he knew about the patient to the patient. And let me just give you a good example. Before this oral argument, as I often do, I call out a colleague and I ask, you know, I have an oral argument tomorrow. Here are the issues. Here are my facts. And my colleague gives me great ideas. I rely on those ideas, and I make my argument. There's no intent that he's going to represent Dr. Pavoros that there's a formal consultation. The intent is that I, as the attorney of record, will use that information. If I find it helpful, I can reject it, I can accept it. But it's my responsibility how I deal with it.
Let me change the facts on you. Dr. Prevost said, you know, I've met this other lawyer, and I hear he's the top appellate lawyer in town. I would like you to call him and follow whatever advice that he tells you. And Dr. Prevost never met this other lawyer you're talking to, and you follow your client's instructions, and this special appellate lawyer tells you what to do. Did he undertake a duty in that situation? The other lawyer.
Well, this is what I'm trying to tell you. If I were formally consulted, I would think that the first thing I would do is try to exercise my independent judgment, which means I don't take the person's word for it. I say, can I see your briefs? Can I examine them? Can I talk to your client? Can I certainly would record my consultation in writing, what my advice is. We have none of that here. What we have is a colleague calling up and saying, I'm going to brainstorm some idea, acting as a sounding board, and the Dr. Kavanaugh could use it, not use it, however he wants.
And that's supposed to be precisely my question, Mr. Yun, because as you know, we're in a motion, let's assume we're in the motion to dismiss phase. We have to assume the truth of the allegations. I'm worried a little bit whether I have enough facts to know. And it may turn out just what was the allegation. If the allegation was what you just said, we're just brainstorming and whatever else, I think there's a very strong argument there's no duty in that context. If the allegation were more, I call this person because he's the expert, he's the neurologist, I'm not. And he knew I was relying on him. We all knew that. I think that's a different case. And that's coming back to Judge Roman's question. Do we have enough in this complaint to assume the allegations what you said as opposed to the other hypothetical?
Well, that is their obligation.
So right.
Sufficient facts to state a claim upon which relief could be granted, and they did not. And if all we have is a phone call between Kavanaugh and Pavot, and alleged reliance. That's all we have, and we have Dr. Pearson's telling you that it was to do an MRI the next day. That's what we have. And we don't have any allegation. If the court's worried about whether, it could have been different, we have their own admissions all over the opening brief. It says Dr. Pavot never met, examined, seen, or treated Mr. Dingell. That's in the opening brief on page 2, in Judge Montgomery's order, page 2. Dr. Pavot never reviewed medical records, diagnostic tests. We know that because in the complaint, paragraph 17, it says all the information was given by Kavanaugh to Pavot. Kavanaugh called him on March 21. That's on the complaint in paragraph 17. The phone call was not charted in the medical record. That's indicated on page 2 of the opening brief. Mr. Daigle and his wife was not even aware of the phone call. That's on page 2 of the opening brief. Those are under those, and the, oh, and the very next day, when Mr. Daigle's hospitalized, did Dr. Perot follow up? No. They allege in paragraph 21, a different neurologist was consulted. All this indicates that there was no physician-patient relationship. All those things indicate that this is a colleague calling up another colleague and asking what happened. I know here, Mr. So I think that is sufficient, but if that's not, it's their obligation to plead sufficient facts to prove it. But I don't think he can because he admitted all these things in the opening brief. For all those reasons, we ask the court to affirm the district court's judgment. And I believe if it's a 12B5, we are entitled to attorney fees incurred on appeal. Thank you. Thank you. The first of all, regarding a few of the questions that Mr. Yoon answered, particularly on malfeasance versus nonfeasance, I believe it came up about whether Dr. Pavot did any affirmative act. In paragraph 20 of the complaint, it's alleged that Dr. Kavanaugh's diagnosis and treatment of Mr. Daigle was based in part on the recommendations of Dr. Pavot. So there is something, some affirmative act.
Is there anything in the pleading to tell us what those recommendations were? I mean, he could have said, take his blood pressure. There's nothing, I can't see anything in the pleading that says what recommendations you allege were made. Is there anything?
Not in the pleading.
Okay.
Regarding the negligence versus medical malpractice, I think one of you mentioned it, regardless of what the label is put on it, actually the label is negligence under the first claim for relief. The title says wrongful death of James Daigle by negligence. Again, in Colorado, the physician-patient relationship is not required. Defense keeps arguing in this case a little bit of a straw man in that they're asking, they being us, are asking Dr. Pavot to diagnose and treat. And we were not asking him to diagnose and treat. We're asking him to give proper advice. He did give advice. We're just asking it to be proper. We think it was negligent advice. We would like the court to consider the other factors other than the 5 mentioned in the traditional duty cases, one of them being assumption of duty. Dr. Pavot did not assume the duty to treat. He didn't assume the duty to diagnose necessarily, but he did assume the duty to give advice. And I think he should be held under 324A, the restatement of torts, to that duty, to the extent that he assumed that duty. That is, he listened to the whole thing and he gave advice.
So there's, Dr. Pearson, is there a duty in any case where there's a consult, if somebody says anything? That's what I was trying to get at before. It's one thing to advise how to treat a specific patient in a specific way. If that's your allegation, I think you have somewhat of a problem based on the limitations of your complaint. It's a different thing if he calls, and it's analogous to, instead of looking something up in a medical encyclopedia, I called somebody and he gave me a definition of a term. That, I suppose, is giving advice, but I don't think there's a duty in that situation. I'm concerned you're painting a little bit broadly.
Well, I'll paint much more specifically now.
Please.
In that, what I would say is that in a case like this, the answer to your first question is no, all phone calls don't lead to a duty. The ones that do involve the ones where you take all the factors and they add up to a duty. But in this case, one of the other factors I'd like you to consider, in addition to the assumption of the duty and the actual malfeasance versus nonfeasance, is the specificity versus the generality, which is exactly what you were hitting on. And that is, this was a specific phone call with a specific conversation
by a specific doctor to another specific doctor regarding a specific patient who was still in the office awaiting diagnosis with a dangerous condition. The phone call was made specifically for the purpose of obtaining advice, and the consultant was given all the facts. And it's foreseeable, given the general practitioner versus the neurologist in this case, that advice would be followed. And in a case like that, when you have that much specificity, I would say, considering all the other factors as well, that really weighs heavily in favor of establishing a duty as compared to just, well, I've had a lot of patients in here lately, they've had ear infections, they're allergic to penicillin, they're already on Ceftriaxone. What do you use in general? That's kind of a curbside consult. Thank you.
Thank you both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. As I said,